So we're going to be in Matthew chapter 20, looking at another parable of Jesus. Please turn there. I'm going to go ahead and read the parable, and we'll go work our way through it. So this is Matthew 20. We'll read, actually I'll start at 19, verse 30. And then read through 20, verse 16. But many who are first will be last, and the last first. For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And to them he said, "You go into the vineyard too. And whatever is right, I will give you." So they went. Going out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, "Why do you stand here idle all day?" And they said to him, "Because no one has hired us." He said to them, "You go into the vineyard too." And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first." And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more. But each of them also received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour. And you have made them equal to us, who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat?" But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge me my generosity?" So the last will be first, and the first last. So we've come now to the third part of this section in Matthew's gospel. We've been spending about, this is the third week, on the section that began with Jesus' discussion with the rich young ruler, the rich young man, and the call to discipleship and his unwillingness to part with his earthly possessions to have treasure in heaven. And to have eternal life, the eternal life that he was seeking. And we see that Jesus used that to teach the disciples something about the nature of his kingdom. What they expected or who they expected to actually enter into the kingdom, which would be the rich young man, right? It's a prime candidate for entering into the kingdom. He's actually not going to make it unless God does a miracle. What is possible or what is impossible with man is now possible with God. The only way for that young man to enter into the kingdom is if God chooses to be generous, which is what the parable of the laborers in the vineyard is about. It's about God's generosity. We see that Jesus has been teaching his disciples about the kingdom of heaven. You see it all the way back, even to verse 10, 11, 12 of chapter 19. Where he talks about the eunuchs, those who make themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom, about the little children to whom Jesus says belongs the kingdom. And yet the disciples try to keep the children from Jesus. And about the call to enter the kingdom that Jesus gives the rich young man. We even see this looking forward into the next section in chapter 20. Where the question is raised about those who can have the right and left hand of Jesus and be seated in those positions of authority and prominence in his kingdom. That is what the mother of the sons of Zebedee asked Jesus. "Can my boys sit at your right hand and your left hand in your kingdom?" So I think throughout this whole section, we do see an emphasis upon the kingdom of heaven. And I think this parable is actually designed to demonstrate to the disciples and challenge the assumptions that the disciples have in the way that Jesus has already done that by speaking of eunuchs, by speaking of children, by speaking of those who are who are not hindered by their riches. And then later on in chapter 20, by speaking about what true authority and power looks like in his kingdom. It does not look like positions of authority, but it looks like service. So the parable has to fit into that context in some way. And it's kind of our responsibility to figure out exactly how it fits into that context. It's easy to see the structure. The structure is not a mystery. You have, beginning in 19:30, the statement that Jesus gives to his disciples, many who are first will be last, and the last first. And you see the reverse of that in chapter 20, verse 16. The last will be first, and the first last. So we know that it has to somehow explain that statement. If he begins with it and he ends with it, the parable has something to do with that statement. The great unexpected reversal that takes place within God's kingdom. And the parable itself is easy to see. It comes in two parts. The first part, in verses 1 through 7, is about the master of the house who goes into the marketplace to hire laborers at multiple times throughout the day. Laborers that he then sends out into his vineyard to work. And then in verses 8 through 15, it is about the payment those laborers receive. So that's kind of the structure. And what we're going to do is we're just going to work our way through it and then see what conclusions we can draw at the end. So the passage begins like this. The kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. So this parable is a parable about the kingdom of heaven, or the kingdom of God. And what he likens the kingdom of heaven to is to a master of a house. A master of a house who we will find out is actually God himself. So the kingdom is like a God who goes out into a marketplace or a town square and hires laborers for his vineyard. The interesting thing about the parables that Jesus tells us is that some of them he explains and some of them he doesn't. When he does explain the parables and the different particulars of the parables, that explanation is only given to the disciples. So we see this in Matthew 13, where Jesus tells them that they are the privileged ones to whom has been given the secrets of the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. So they are given the inside knowledge to understand what the parables are really about. To those on the outside, the secrets have not been given. So they're kind of left in the dark to figure out what the parables mean themselves. I think we see a little bit of this even with reading from Luke 15. When it's clear that Jesus is actually using the parables to teach the Pharisees. So the Pharisees are complaining that the tax collectors and the prostitutes are coming to Jesus. So Jesus tells them a story about how hypocritical they actually are. So you see a clear example of that in the parable of the prodigal son. That parable is not necessarily about the son who left his father and was welcomed back, as much as it is about the older son, the other brother, who stayed home and was faithful and yet did not celebrate when God extended grace, when the Father extended grace to the disobedient and rebellious son. So even in that story, we see Jesus describing the hypocrisy and the self-righteousness of the Pharisees. Jesus is extending grace to the tax collectors and the prostitutes, and they should be celebrating, and yet they're the ones who are complaining, just like the older brother. I think this parable touches on some of those same elements as the parable of the prodigal son. But this is a parable about the kingdom of heaven. It's like a master of a house. The kingdom that God would actually establish through Christ's own death and resurrection and ascension. The same kingdom that John the Baptist and Jesus announced was at hand or near. The same kingdom that Jesus promised some of his disciples would see coming in power before they die. So that is the kingdom that Jesus is describing. It's not the kingdom that the Jews expected. So we can assume then that how the kingdom works and what happens within the kingdom is going to be different than what the Jews expected. And I think that's, what we find here in the parable. But this parable is unique to Matthew's gospel. It does not show up in any of the other gospels. And it is told to the disciples, but Jesus does not give us an explanation. So that may make several elements of the parable a little bit more challenging to understand because we're kind of left to interpret it ourselves, and we'll look at a few of those issues later on. But it is definitely given to the disciples, and that's going to play a part in how we understand and interpret it as we go through it. So it's a parable of the kingdom of heaven. Second, the parable begins as we would expect it to. So this seems to be just like a snapshot of what life looked like in the agrarian society that Jesus and all of his disciples were used to. What does it look like? Well, it looks like someone who is in need of workers, who then goes to the place where the workers gathered every day, waiting to be hired for the day, and then that master of the house or the owner of the vineyard actually hiring workers to work in his vineyard, to work in his house. So that's what it looks like. And we see that this owner of the house, or the master of the house, the lord of the house, goes to the town square early in the morning at first light. He goes out, and presumably this would be around 6 a.m., and we could guess that by the amount of trips that the master of the house took to the market and the amount of workers that we're assuming he hired, this is a busy time. Most likely this is the time of the harvest when the master of the house would need as many workers as he could get. So the picture we have then seems very simple. This is what you would normally encounter every day during the time of the harvest in the marketplace. Now, the day laborers here that are hired, these are compared to probably in the social structure of the day, they're probably slightly above slaves. They obviously do not have their own vineyards to care for, or else they would be working in them and hiring their own laborers. And they are not employees or clients of some other vineyard. So they depend upon the work that is provided for them or that they are hired for that particular day. And we'll see a little bit of how that plays a part in our understanding as we go through. So we can assume that these laborers were poor, maybe not landowners themselves, and were dependent upon day work for their wages. The picture I kind of have in my mind is the pictures or maybe the films we've seen of the Great Depression, when you have a number of men meeting in certain places within the towns, and then some employers coming to the place where all the men gather, and they're kind of picking a handful of men to come and work for them for the day. That's kind of the picture that I have of this. Now, the parable continues like this in three-hour increments. So what we see then in verses 3 to 5 is something similar to what we saw in 1 and 2. Going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And to them he said, "You go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you." And so they went. And then going out again to the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. So what are we to make of this? Well, we could infer from this that the lord of the house, the vineyard owner, is desperate for workers, similar to most businesses nowadays. The desperation is probably driven by the time of year, the time of the harvest. There's a greater sense of urgency. We got to get the grapes in. We got to gather them at the right time before they go bad. But we don't exactly know for sure. What we see that is different here in this example is that the owner of the vineyard, the master of the house, he says that he will pay the workers that are sent out at the third hour of the day what is right. So you don't have the emphasis upon the denarius for the payment, as you see in the first two verses. The importance of that phrase, I think I didn't mention that. The importance of the payment of a denarius is key because that's what's going to cause all the conflict later on. So he mentions it there with the first workers, but he doesn't mention it here with the workers that are sent out at the third or the sixth or the ninth hour. So basically, the ancient conception of time was that, you know, the day would be split up into halves, and the day would be, you know, from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. And that 12-hour period then was how they're actually calculating the time here. So if the day began at 6 a.m., which is probably about the time that it began, you would have the workers that are sent out at the third hour, it would be 9 a.m., the sixth hour would be 12 p.m., the ninth hour would be 3 in the afternoon. So that was kind of how they split the day up. The assumption that we can make is that whatever is right, whatever is just payment for these workers that are sent to work for, well, for 9 hours, right, from 9 to 6 at night, they would be paid whatever 3/4 of a denarius is. I don't know if they had a coin for that, or if they just counted out shekels or whatever it might be. If the laborers who start the day at 6 and work till 6 are going to be paid a denarius, then the laborers who start the day at 9 and work till 6 will be paid 75% of that. So that would be how they would calculate their payment. And it seems to be implied in the statement that the owner of the vineyard says when he says, "I'll give you whatever is right. I'll pay you what you deserve for the work that you perform." So the owner of the vineyard continues this pattern until the 11th hour. Now this is, I think, until this point, the most surprising element of the parable. Why on earth would you go out at 5 p.m. to hire someone to work until 6 p.m.? Is there that much work to do? Could you expect that they would actually contribute that much? Why would you hire a day laborer for an hour's worth of work? So this is what Jesus says. "At about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. He said to them, 'Why do you stand here idle all day?' They said to him, 'Because no one has hired us.' He said to them, 'You go into the vineyard too.'" So notice how this kind of breaks the pattern a little bit more. There's an additional question that the owner of the vineyard asks. Why do you stand here idle all day? Now it seems to imply that they have been there since the beginning of the day. We don't know if they just showed up late. We don't know that if the owner of the vineyard was looking for workers, then why didn't he just hire all of the workers that were there at 6 a.m.? So the repeated coming back and asking and looking for more laborers throughout the day seems to imply that there wasn't that many laborers there. But these guys apparently have been standing idle all day. They haven't been doing anything. So they've been waiting in the marketplace. Maybe these are the lazy people who have bad reputations and who do not, maybe their hands are nice and soft and there's no calluses. Maybe they don't look like they can do a good hard day's worth of labor. But they've just been chit-chatting the whole entire day. And Jesus asks them about this, and they say that no one has hired us. The reason why we've been standing here all day is because no one's hired us. So he still sends them out into his vineyard. Doesn't say how much he's going to pay them, but he sends them out for an hour's worth of work. So, I think it's safe to assume that these workers were probably the lousiest, either by looks or by reputation of the bunch. So even if they were present all the other times the vineyard owner showed up, they weren't among those who were selected. And yet, at this point of the day, the vineyard owner still sends them out for some work. So that's basically the first section of the parable. Confusing elements, yes. questions that we have that aren't not necessarily answered by the parable, but I think can be explained once we understand the point of it all. So now it's come time to pay the laborers. It's payday. Best time of the day, right? Clocking out and you're collecting your check. So the laborers are to be paid. All of them that have been called at different parts of the day, throughout the day, the time has now come for them to receive their wage, to receive what they are due. In this way, we see that the vineyard owner is actually following the stipulations of the law. The law required that day laborers would be paid on that day. This is what Deuteronomy 24 says. It says, "You shall not oppress a hired worker who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your brothers or one of the sojourners who are in your land within your town. You shall give him his wages on the same day before the sun sets, for he is poor and counts on it, lest he cry against you to the Lord and you be guilty of sin." So the law then, in Leviticus 19:13, Deuteronomy 24:14-15, the law makes payment due a matter of oppression, of taking advantage of the poor and needy for work that they have performed for your benefit. So the law is protecting the day laborers, who at that point in time were most likely the poor and the needy. They are in need of the wage that they've earned that day. They have no savings, there's no refrigeration, there's no food except for the food that they can buy with the wages that they've earned. So the person who hires them cannot sit on those wages until the next day or until the end of the week or whenever payday falls. They must be paid out that day. And that's what Jesus says here. Verse 8. "When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, 'Call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first.'" Now, as we'll see, the emphasis or the focus is going to be upon the relationship between the last and the first. So we don't even have any examples of the people who were hired at the third or the sixth or the ninth hour being paid. It's all about the last and the first. And what you see is actually with paying the last first, that is what's going to actually provide the conflict. If Jesus had just told, you know, if the master of the house had told the foreman here, who, you know, is playing a role, but he's not prominent to the story, if he had told him to pay those who were hired first, if he told them to pay them first, then we wouldn't have a conflict. We wouldn't have a parable. Because it's when the first see what the last are paid that they get their hopes up. And they think that they're actually going to get more than what they agreed to beginning in the day. So let's see how it goes down. Verse 9, "When those hired about the 11th hour, when they came, each of them received a denarius." Each of them received one day's wage. It's quite extraordinary. You do an hour's worth of work, and you get paid as if you had done 12. All the laborers who worked 1 hour were paid as if they had worked 12. All those who were standing around the marketplace, idle all day, were paid as if they had been working the whole entire time. Now, this is extraordinarily generous of the owner of the vineyard. They're paid quite well for not doing that much work. Now, it's quite extraordinary. Even beyond that, it's extravagant. It's excessively generous. And this act of supreme generosity is not explained. Right? He doesn't say why the owner of the vineyard paid them a denarius, just that he did pay him a denarius. And I think we're left to kind of wonder why, but that is not exactly the point. The point is that they were paid a day's wage for doing an hour's worth of work. So their pay is not commensurate to their labor the work that they were able to perform, unless they were just really good workers. I don't know if there's anybody that is that good of a worker. So this act then of supreme generosity, this act of excessive generosity has an effect on those who had started work at the beginning of the day. This is what complicates things. So in verse 10, now when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more. But each of them also received a denarius. So has anyone ever been in that position? Where your expectations were you were actually going to receive more payment. Maybe because of an act of generosity or because you didn't know what the wage was for the work you were doing. Remember in high school once I went to Buck Bales and I had never bucked bales before. And I had no idea what I should be paid. And my friend and I bucked bales for 9 hours, and I was paid $45. So how many dollars is that per hour? Nobody knows?
Five.
Yeah. $5 an hour. I was like, well, I didn't have any expectations, so I guess I'm just going to have to take it, right? My friend was upset because he thought that he should be paid a lot more than $5 an hour. And maybe that was our fault for not figuring that out beforehand. So he actually called up the person who paid us, who we bucked bales for, and said that he deserves to be paid more. And we were. And I felt horrible about it, but I kept the money. So here they are, they see the guys who come in last, they work for an hour and they're paid a day's wage. So what do you think their expectation was? Well, if they were paid a day's wage for an hour's worth of work, we worked 12 hours. So we should be paid 12 days' wages. We should be paid 12 denarius. Right? I mean, isn't that how your mind would work? Isn't the laborer worthy of his wages? That's how my mind would work. So they assumed that the payment they were going to receive would be commensurate with the amount of work they had done. They inferred that based upon what the one-hour laborers received, they would receive maybe even 11 times what the one-hour laborers received. If the one-hour laborers received a single denarius, then they should receive a total of 12 denarius. But what do they receive? They received a denarius. They received a single denarius. And instead of being grateful for the work and the pay that they can provide for their families, have food to eat that night, they flip out. So verses 11 and 12. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us, who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." So their initial response, disappointing as it was to their new expectations, was to grumble. They complained. They believed that they had been treated unfairly, that they were deserving of more pay since they had done more work. Their work had been performed in the hardest part of the day. They had done the bulk of the labor, and they had done it during the heat of the day. The hottest part of the day. And these guys come in at the end of the day when it's nice and cool in the afternoon, and they just simply do a little cleanup, and they get paid the same that we get paid. Something has gone terribly wrong. Injustice has been done. The 11th hour laborers were being treated as equals with those who had worked 12 hours. So they complain. So what is the master of the house to do? Now, from his perspective, we can assume he does not want to be accused of injustice or unfairness. since he would have a hard time hiring day laborers tomorrow, the day after. He seems to have a need of them, so he needs to keep up a good reputation. Now, he could recognize his mistake of paying the last laborers first, since if the first had been paid first, then they would not be waiting around to see what the last laborers were going to be paid. Maybe he could, you know, make a commitment that he would not do that the next day. Now, he could bite the bullet this time and make sure he doesn't make the same mistake in the future, right? He could take the denarius back for the 11th hour laborers and give them a few shekels instead. It would be better to make the guys who only worked an hour mad instead of those who had worked 12 hours, right? So what do you do if you're a business owner? What do you do in this situation? And some see this merely as kind of an economic lesson, right? Christian business owner, and this is how you ought to treat your employees. So what is the master of the house to do? Well, he does have an approach here. And of course, as only Jesus can, it seems to be an amazingly wise approach. So the first thing he does is he reminds the first laborers of the original agreement. But he replied to one of them, maybe this was the one that was provoking all the others, causing the complaining and murmuring. We all know these people. He replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius?" So he reminds the worker, whom he addresses as a friend, of the original agreement, what they had shook on, what they had agreed to. "You go out and you work in my vineyard and I'll pay you a day's wage. I'll pay you a denarius." And they were happy to do it. After all, they went out and they worked the whole entire day. That's what it says in verse 2, right? After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. They went knowing how much they were going to be paid for the work that they were going to perform. This is what they had agreed to. This was the original contract. They would work for a denarius a day, and they were obviously happy enough or desperate enough to do it because that is what they did. How can they grumble and complain and accuse the owner of the vineyard of some injustice or unfairness if he's doing what they agreed to do? They have no ground to stand on. They agree to be paid a denarius for their labor. That's what they were paid. The owner of the vineyard has not wronged them. "I have doing you no wrong." So that is the first tactic that the owner of the vineyard takes. The second thing the master of the house does is he informs the first laborers of his freedom to do what he wants with what he has. It's his money, right? Can he not do with it what he wants? I think this is where we see the real genius of Jesus. "Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Take it and go. This is what you agreed to. I choose of my own free will, my free initiative, to do what I want, to pay this last worker the same that I paid to you. I've done you no wrong." To paraphrase, we could say this: you agreed to work for a denarius. Here is your denarius. Take it. It's yours. You go and do what you want with it. I'm doing what I want with what is mine. And I choose to give the last worker the same I gave you. Isn't that my right? Or am I not free to do as I wish? Is there some law that prevents me from doing what I want with what is mine? Am I enslaved by your misguided sense of fairness or injustice? No. I am free, And I choose to be generous, way beyond anyone's expectations. There is no law against this. That's in essence what he's saying. Now the second question that follows this, in verse 15, is kind of butchered by the ESV. So, ESV says this, "Or do you begrudge my generosity?" And that's an attempt to kind of translate this phrase. Literally, he says, "Or is your eye evil because I am good?" I think begrudging my generosity is a little soft. What he's doing here is he's actually making a very important point. And it's a matter of good and evil. Is your eye evil because I am good? Now, what does this do for us? It actually brings us all the way back to chapter 19, verse 17. When the rich young man approaches Jesus and asks him, "What good deed must I do to have eternal life?" And Jesus responds, "Why do you ask me about what is good? There is only one who is good." And now the master of the house is saying, "I am good." So I think the connection then is clear. We are to understand the master of the house as being God, who can do what he wants with what is his. And that's the essence of what he's getting at here. He can do what he wants with what is his. He can choose to be as generous as he wants to be to whomever he wants to be generous to. Even the guys who come in late. Even the guys who've been sitting there all day long waiting to be called to work. Perhaps they've refused. Perhaps they're lazy. Perhaps they're soft. Perhaps they're just not really willing to do the work. God can still be generous to them. So it makes it a matter of good and evil. The evil eye, interestingly, is a picture of someone who is stingy with their possessions. Someone who is envious of others. And it's interesting that the phrase is actually picked up back in Deuteronomy. So this is what Deuteronomy says. This is about the Sabbath year, the seventh year. So this is how Moses warns the Israelites about having an evil eye toward their brother. So he says, "Take care lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart, and you say, 'The seventh years, the year of release is near,' and your eye be evil on your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cried to the Lord against you, and you be guilty of sin." It's similar language to what we see in Deuteronomy 24, where Moses is telling them about how they ought to treat those that work for them for the day, right? Give them the wage that they've earned for that day. Don't be stingy, but pay it out to them. Don't sit on their wages until the next day. Here, the seventh year is approaching, and the warning is for those that are going to be released on the seventh year. So they are indentured servants, and they are going to be released on the seventh year. They are told then that they send these men out, send these brothers out with their flocks full. Their hands are full of flocks. They have wheat that they are given to by the person who releases them, and their wine vats are full. So you do not send them out with empty hands. You actually send them out. So you do not think to yourself, "Man, this person is going to be free next year. What I'm going to do is I'm going to hold on to what is mine so that they go out empty-handed." That's the evil eye. So it's interesting that Jesus actually weaves it into this parable, because it is important to see that the evil eye that he addresses here is this eye of stinginess. An eye that despises generosity. An eye that is envious of what others have or what others receive. So if you could call, by saying begrudging my generosity, that points the emphasis upon the grumbling or the complaining. And that's not necessarily the sin. The sin is the envy or the stinginess that is directed towards others. So these laborers cannot rejoice in the fact that their brothers have been paid the same wage that they've been paid. They cannot rejoice and celebrate the fact that God has, or the master of the house, has been generous to them. Their mind is only fixated on the evil that's been done to them, that they have not received what they think they deserve. And all the while, the master of the house sees his compensation, his excessive generosity, as good. I am good. He is good because he has done what he wants with what is his. He's given beyond what the laborers have deserved. So then the parable concludes with verse 16. So the last will be first, and the first last. Like I said earlier, this is the reverse of what we see in 1930. But many who are first will be last, and the last first. We could say that this is the moral of the story. This is the point of the parable, that there is a reversal that's going to take place. Whether that is within the kingdom itself, that seems to be where Jesus is going with the parable, or at the last day, the final judgment. I think it's probably better to see it in the kingdom itself, since Jesus is talking about those who are entering the kingdom, and those who are laboring in the kingdom, and the God who gives generously to those in the kingdom. It's easy to see, I think, in 1930, that Jesus is actually using that statement to challenge the assumption of the disciples. They think that the rich person is going to be first in line, and Jesus is saying, no, that's a complete opposite. You guys, my disciples, who have given up everything and followed me, are actually going to be first. The rich are going to be last. Now, that interpretation makes the statement in verse 16 here more challenging to understand, because we have to figure out who the main players in the parable actually represent. I think we can agree solidly that the master of the house is God himself. He is the one that is doing what he wants with what he has. He is the one being exceedingly generous to those who do not deserve it. Those guys who work for an hour don't deserve a day's wage, but yet it's God's prerogative to actually pay them that. So who are the laborers that are sent out into the vineyard? What is the vineyard? So later on in chapter 21, we actually see a couple more parables in which Jesus actually uses the vineyard language to describe the people of Israel. And it's possible here that that's what the vineyard represents. But the focus is not on the vineyard like it is in the other parables. The focus is on the workers, the laborers. So who are they? Now there's a number of options. Well, we could think that the workers, the first workers, are the Jews in general, and the last workers are the disciples. Now that fits verse 6, our understanding of verse 16 in chapter 19, verse 30. We know the disciples are going to be first. But does that make sense of the parable? We could think that the first workers are the disciples, and the last workers, those who come into the kingdom through their testimony. So then it makes this a matter of the kingdom itself. And the implicit application would be directed then towards the disciples. Do not grumble and complain at God's generosity to those who come later on into my kingdom through your very testimony. So we could take that position. We could see the first workers as believing Jews and the last workers as believing Gentiles. God is going to extend his grace even to the pagans. Do you think the Jews expected that? Do you think they celebrated that? Or do you think that they kind of had an evil eye towards those that God had accepted, to those who were uncircumcised and yet accepted by God. To those that God had poured out his spirit upon, just as he poured out his spirit upon them. That does seem to fit the dynamics that we see happening in the New Testament. But is that what the parable is about? It's possible. We do see that the rich, those were those who were assumed to be first in line, and they're going to end up last. The disciples, then, the last, who gave up everything to follow Jesus, are going to end up first. But the parable seems to be speaking of those who are in the kingdom of heaven, since they all receive the same payment. They all get a denarius. The point of the parable is not that some will be excluded, but that the latecomers receive the same as those who have been there from the beginning. And that is a matter of God's extravagant grace, his goodness, his mercy. Those who have been standing idly by until the 11th hour are treated by sheer mercy the same as those who have worked the whole day. For those who have been there all along, toiling for hours. It can appear that they're getting the short end of the stick, and they could be tempted to think that way. I think it depends upon how we understand the parable. Is this an encouragement to the disciples, or is it a rebuke of the disciples? We know that Jesus has just given the disciples an encouraging word. When the Son of Man sits on his glorious throne, you guys, you 12, minus Judas, plus Matthias, are going to sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. You guys are going to have authority. You guys are actually going to be rewarded for giving everything up and following me. So the parable would then be an encouragement to the disciples, right? Look at what's going to happen. You guys are going to be first in line. God is going to extend mercy even to you, far more than you deserve. But we could also read the parable as a rebuke of Peter's question in verse 27. What then will we have? We've given up everything and followed you. What are we going to get out of it? What are we going to receive? And then Jesus says, let me tell you a little parable. If you're thinking about what you're going to earn, or what you're going to merit, or what wage you think you deserve, let me tell you a little parable. There's actually going to be people that come in that I'm going to show more grace to. I'm going to show more generosity to. And they're going to have the same that you actually have also. They're going to have the same reward. They're going to share in my kingdom. They're going to share in my rule. They're going to judge as well. So if you think this is about what you earn, what you deserve by your labor and your hard work, then let me tell you a little parable. That's how I read it. That's not how everybody reads it, but that's how I read it. I think he's challenging the disciples. I think he's challenging them because they are of that same mindset. They do not understand grace. They do not understand God's freedom to be gracious. They have just prevented the children from coming to him because they don't see the children as being important. Their mind is still blown because the rich man walked away from Jesus. The person that they thought was automatically in. And Jesus says, no, actually, it's impossible for him to get in. The only way he gets in is by my generosity, my grace, my extravagance. That's the only way anyone gets in. And even if you've been with me from the beginning, you've started out as my disciples, my 12 that I have called, that I've chosen, that I've appointed to bear fruit. Do not look down upon those who come in later. Because you're all going to receive grace. And it is only ever by grace. So this parable is about the freedom of God to be excessively generous to the point where people are tempted to be envious, to the point where people are prompted to grumble towards God's apparent lack of fairness, or to the point where they question God's rights or his justice or his goodness. Can God really save that person? The only reason why we ask that question is because we don't understand his grace towards us. If we understand his grace towards us, that God has actually been generous to us far more than I deserve, that's the only way we can understand how God can be gracious to others. So in a way, it is a rebuke of the disciples, but it continues to be a rebuke of us, because I think we still suffer from the same mindset. I've been a Christian since I was 5 years old. I've always served God, and things have been hard. And so-and-so gets saved at 65. And they get to share in God's kingdom and his reward. A person who's lived a defiant, rebellious, sinful life for 65 years, and I've been the faithful servant, and they get to share in God's reward. Do you not think that we struggle with that? We have to be just as cautious about an evil eye as the disciples here. So God is free. He is gloriously, lavishly free to be generous. And how generous is he? Well, he keeps coming back to the marketplace. He keeps coming back hour after hour. And even the lazy guys get called and sent out into the vineyard for work. Do not despise or grumble or complain at God's generosity, because he loves it. He loves to be generous. He loves to be gracious. He loves to lavish people with stuff that they don't deserve, and to not give them what they do deserve. Craig Keener says this. He says, a parable of grace challenges those who operate on a principle of merit. So wherever we find ourselves, if those dynamics are there, a grace or a works or a grace or a merit mindset, this is always going to challenge us. This is how God rules. This is a kingdom. This is a parable about the God who reigns, the God who rules. And how does he rule? He rules through generosity. He establishes his reign through sheer mercy and excessive generosity. God chooses to give as he wills, and that is the only basis for his kingdom. If we are willing to receive that, then we're willing to receive everything else that he offers to us. Let's pray.